You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Happy Wednesday, everybody. How are you? How's it going? How you feeling? Here we are deep, deep, deep into the election. Do you know 5.7 million people have already voted? Early voting's massive. And, you know, that's pretty consequential because as all the leaders are making their final pitch to close the deal. Aaron O'Toole saying today, this is not your father's conservative party. This is not your grandfather's conservative party. Look at us again. We're new. We're different. Justin Trudeau says, this is about vaccines and this is about climate. And Jagmeet Singh says, this is about broken promises. The truth is, it doesn't matter. Because in Canada, well, it matters. But millions of people have already voted. Like, it's unbelievable. Now, the question is, where will votes break? 5.8 million Canadians have cast an early ballot. So they're done. These closing arguments don't matter. But for three quarters of the electorate, that's about a quarter of the electorate or more. It matters. And this is a toss-up election. I think we're going to get a minority government one way or the other, blue or red. Quebec's up it for grabs. So I was thinking about that today. I was thinking about how they're all, you know, Justin Trudeau's trying to pitch himself as the man who can fulfill promises, even though the opposition says you can't fulfill your promises. You're Mr. Broken Promise. Big targets, no results. He's saying big targets to solve big problems. Aaron O'Toole saying, please, please don't mistake me for Stephen Harper or Andrew Scheer. I'm the guy in the middle. I remember you thought I was true blue. True blue? I'm not true blue like I was in the leadership. Look, I'm pro-choice and I've got a price on carbon and I'm not even sure I'm now. First I said the Trans Mountain Pipeline I'm going to rebuild. Now it's not even a product. I'd like it, but there's not even a thing there. And I'm not sure. I'm definitely going to rip up the childcare agreements with Quebec. But now he wrote a letter to Legault saying, well, maybe you could keep part of the $6 billion, maybe all of the $6 billion. I don't know, $6 billion. Guns, I'm definitely going to roll back the ban on the 1,500 assault weapon. Nah, I'm not going to do that. And maybe I'll look at the... Is Aaron O'Toole's challenge, is he a conservative of convenience or a conservative of conviction? Justin Trudeau, is he a liberal of integrity or a liberal of opportunity? Jagmeet Singh's challenge, is he a progressive candidate who is practical or is he a progressive candidate who is just idealistic? Can he actually do what he says? Or is he there just to spoil? And the Bloc. The Bloc have taken that one question by debate moderator Shachi Curl in the English language debate, which I was a part of, and she asked about this controversial secularization law, which Jagmeet Singh and Aaron O'Toole and Justin Trudeau have all described as discriminatory, but they said, you know, it's already being challenged in court, and it's, you know, that's the provinces to work out. But she phrased the question in such a way that Blanchette seized on it. And remember, nationalism from a political point of view is fueled by these kind of moments of perceived slights and shame. And now the Bloc is surging again. So what does that do? So that's where we're at. That's where we're at. Tight, tight race. You know that. I don't need to tell you that. So we got a great show, and we'll talk more about that. The War Room's here. You know what we're going to talk about in the War Room today? Two things. One, signs of desperation and signs of strength. Is it a sign of desperation that Jean Chrétien is out on the hustings with Justin Trudeau, or a sign of strength? Is it a sign of strength that Mr. Harper hasn't once appeared beside Aaron O'Toole, or is it a sign of strength or a sign of desperation that he doesn't want Mr. Harper anywhere near this? You tell me. Sign of strength? Is it a sign of strength that Justin Trudeau is in Halifax. Remember, they won every single seat in Atlantic Canada in 2015, or is that a sign of desperation? Why is Mr. O'Toole in Quebec? Sign of strength? Sign of strength? Because he's got to protect his 10 seats and he sees growth? Or sign of desperation? My God, we could lose our 10 seats. Now I got to get in there and shore up support. You tell me. So this is what this election's all about right now. The ground game, the closing. But I have to tell you something on a personal note, because tonight is what in the Jewish faith is called Erev Yom Kippur, Kol Nidre. This is the holiest night in the Jewish calendar, and this is the night, the Day of Atonement. And the word atonement is at-one-ment. And what you do if you practice is, not only do you attend a service tonight at your local synagogue, your community, you have dinner with your family, and then you begin at sundown to fast, no food and no water for 24 hours. And you reflect on things, and it's quite somber, right? It's a reflection on what you've done right and wrong. And one of the things that you're supposed to do is, if you've offended people, you're supposed to apologize. And the tradition is you're supposed to apologize publicly. Because, and if you've apologized, if you've offended someone, you're supposed to publicly apologize. And if they reject it, you have to do it again. And if they reject it, then you do it again. But on the third time, you're absolved. It's not your issue. You've tried. But this notion of public apology, of at one minute is what's called turning. Like there's a turning. The word is teshuvah, like a turning toward doing better. And I was thinking about that today because I'm not going to be with my family. My wife is traveling for work, which is rare, but it was a long time planned. And one of my kids is away from home right now. And we saw her at the last holiday, but not this one, my daughter. My son and I will be alone. My parents and my family are all in Toronto. My wife's family is all in Toronto. So I'll be candid, a little lonely. I'll have some friends here. It's always a little lonely when you're away from your family on a big holiday. Like imagine at Christmas or Easter or any of the big holidays, Ramadan, whatever you celebrate. But I also thought, and I call my friends and my family and we wish them, you know, have an easy fast and we apologize. And I do that every year. But I realize that in the midst of this election, where there's so much social media and we debate all the time, and I get to rant every day, that I'm just going to say to you, no doubt I have, got things wrong, went over the line, maybe hurt you in a way when I was ranting on something, some of these very complicated, polarizing issues, I'm sorry. I am. I'm sorry. And I'm sorry not to kiss up. And I'm not saying it as an act of spin or PR or to say that I'm wrong, but because I think we've got to look inward a little, especially someone who's got the privilege of a microphone, and reflect a bit on our role and try to be a little more humble. Being humble is not part of being a talk show host. You're supposed to have strong views, and I do. But I also think in 2021 and on days like this and in a time of polarization that we've talked about, I think we also have to have the courage to reflect on our own weaknesses. Anyway, so I say that. I say I'm sorry. And I hope that in the coming days to do better. Still have strong opinions and have fun, but to be more humane and to listen more. We'll take a break. I've got somebody who I respect deeply. He's fought terrorism, and he's next.
finding answers to all your questions. You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show.
Hey, welcome back. One of the big issues in the campaign is the rise of violence. You know, people screaming obscenities at politicians, throwing things at them, defacing signs, anti-Semitism. Two NDP candidates had to basically resign today for anti-Semitic comments. We have not talked much about Islamophobia, even though 3 months ago a family in London, Ontario were killed because of their religion. And then there's this rise of the far right. So I thought we'd kind of talk a little bit more. Like, is something happening here or not? And the guy we always talk to is our friend Mubin Sheikh. Now, he's the former counterterrorism operative. He's a professor of public safety at Seneca College. And you may know Mubin when he was undercover working with the RCMP to take down the Toronto 18, a terror organization. And now there is a documentary about it called Undercover Jihadi. What drives a person to extremism? Here it is.
My path towards violent extremism started in Canada.
When terrorism was about to strike in Canada.
People might be expecting what they saw in London, but what we have planned is much worse.
One man stopped it.
Doing nothing is not an option.
Find out how he risked everything to do the right thing.
The citizens of your country still don't trust you, and your own community, they don't trust you, so you're alone.
The man who went undercover, risked his life to stop that, is Mubin Sheikh, and he joins us now. Mubin, always a pleasure, sir.
Hey, always a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Evan.
Mubin, you and I have talked about your story. Canadians know your story. What are we going to learn new about the operation that stopped the Toronto 18?
Well, I mean, you know, when the case first came out, of course, you know, it hit the media. I know I'm using a generalization, but, you know, it puts out a particular product. People read the headlines and they don't really follow up with it. You know, the arrests happened way back in 2006. There were 4 years of five legal hearings that took place. So there was another round of like information just kind of coming out. But that's stuff that comes out in court that's been cleared and everything. This will give you just on the fallout of the case, generally speaking, because of how people, Canadians, were like, it can't happen here, right? We say this now of so many issues that are happening. It was our introduction to kind of radicalization, and now we're seeing radicalization as something that affects any community and any people and group. And so, you know, here we are kind of 15 years later, and really the question should be, what have we learned since then? You know, where are we now?
Well, where are we?
Well, it's a good question. So, you know, you kind of started your segment with we're not talking about Islamophobia. And again, like, think about that right now, like Muslims getting attacked by, you know, a driver in a truck. You know, we got conditioned to hearing about this ISIS doing it. Right. Then we heard about, you know, the incel Alec Vanassian doing it on Yonge Street in Toronto. So how do we perceive, you know, these acts? And when we, you know, one group does radicalization, but if another group does it and they belong to, let's say, you know, the majority racial group or political group, we may not use the same terms for them. Right. So we need to, the lesson we got to learn is that, look, radicalization isn't just something that happens to brown people. Okay. It's happening across the board. And you also mentioned, of course, the rise of the far right. And we, you know, we need to think about that too as a majority society in Canada.
Mubin, so what should, like, there's a lot to be talking about. Just let's go back to what happened to you. Like, what was the most dangerous moment for you when you went undercover?
Well, I mean, you know, in the end, the group was, you know, they ultimately had one pistol. There was one 9mm pistol in their possession. So in terms of lethal, you know, threats to my life, there were people that we hung around or that we, you know, I was with who they were armed. They were bad people, not necessarily religious, just like gangster types. You know, there were times where, like, I thought, because these guys were always looking out for spies in the group. And they made very clear that any spies that were, you know, located would be killed, right? I think CSIS was trying to put in somebody in the group for a long time, like really on the inner circle. There were other people who were sent in who were exposed. So the fact that I was able to, you know, do what was required of me put me in positions where I was around people who they would kill you if they knew that you were a spy. So I was always kind of in the back of my mind, this fear that, you know what, I could be just killed in the woods here.
Yeah, of course you could have been. I mean, that was in the, I mean, that's the nature of your job. Do you,
that's right.
Let me just ask you, how important is the undercover work? Like, is that something that should be or likely is going on now?
Oh, yeah. It's a pillar of you know, law enforcement, intelligence, military counterterrorism, eyes on the ground, right? It is a core. I mean, this is used in, you know, organized crime investigations. This is used in all sorts of, you know, child sex predator stings. The undercover is a pillar of counterterrorism operations. The other is, of course, signals intelligence, tapping of phone lines, intercepting, you know, data, communications, encryptions, all this sort of stuff. You know, it's really an ironic because I am right now, as you call me, literally standing outside the new International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. They actually feature me here in a permanent exhibit called Preventing Terror. And basically the story here, what people see when they come here is that this big case, you know, it was an attack that was prevented. And that's the point, that prevention is better than cure, right? Isn't it?
That's interesting. So you're actually featured in the exhibit there.
Yeah, they have a video. They incorporate me into the entire experience. So when you come in here, there's an auditorium. You kind of get, you know, snippets of interviews from different spies like CIA and former KGB and like the whole spy world. And it's crazy to see it. There's Mubin Sheikh. And so they have this screen where it kind of plays and interviews me. There's a glass case in which they have my robe, my boots, my scarf that I wore, and then a plaque.
Is that right? Oh, my God.
These were the basically clothes worn by Mubin Sheikh when he was undercover with the Canadian Security Intelligence Service.
Mubin,
so, it gives a shout-out to Thesis as well.
Which is cool. Mubin, yeah, once you did that undercover work for that, are you burnt? Like, can you ever go undercover again? Like, could you have gone back undercover? Or you're done?
No, I'm done, of course. And I wouldn't even want to. Like, I would if I could. Like, if you know, being able to be public and still doing undercover was possible, which it is not. But that's okay. It's just a part of my experiences. I've gone on to do other things. I'm teaching now as well. So it's
But I mean, like, when you are undercover, like, what don't your friends say, like, hey, Mubin, man, what are you doing? Like, how do you get out of your life? Like, don't your friends and your mom and your dad and your buddies are like, hey, Mubin, man, like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the fallout, there were people who were, like, shocked, of course. Like, they thought, some people they suspected, like, oh, my God, was he just my friend because he was spying on me, right? And it's like, you know, spoiler alert, you're probably not that important to be spied on, okay? But some people, you know, they might have been just associates, just people I knew, but they ran for the hills after, of course, it became public that, you know, I was an undercover. The true friends will always be your true friends, and then they continue to support me to this day, of course. But that's just how it goes, right? It's a controversial tactic, right? I get it. I get how society doesn't understand why we need to do these things, how they actually work, how we should do it properly. Because when you do it the wrong way, then people say, oh, look, it's just entrapment, or the government is creating terror plots and then foiling them. See, the public just doesn't understand what's required in, you know, for these operations. The people you're dealing with are not, you know, Boy Scouts, okay? Like, you're dealing with bad people, and you need to know how to operate in that environment. And if you don't, then, well, you read about the next terrorist attack that just happened.
Mubin Sheikh, new documentary out by Mubin. You can check it out. Google Undercover Jihadi, the story of Mubin Sheikh, former counterterrorism operative, now professor, featured at the museum in Washington. Hey, my friend, thank you for coming on, and congratulations on this. It's a powerful and important story. Thanks, Mubin.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers. Mubin Sheikh, powerful story. Coming up, Jody Wilson-Raybould has just dropped the new book. I spoke with her last night, and I'm going to play you that conversation. Not good things to say about Mr. Trudeau.
As this story changes, we react. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
She's the most dangerous person not running in this election, Jody Wilson-Raybould. Remember when she was the justice minister, she felt she was pressured improperly by Justin Trudeau. The ethics commissioner found Mr. Trudeau guilty of improperly pressing Jody Wilson-Raybould to stop a criminal prosecution of SNC-Lavalin. Now she's got a new memoir bringing it all up. The question is, why publish the book right now in the middle of the election? And what's new? Well, to find out, I spoke with Jody Wilson-Raybould, and I asked her, Justin Trudeau, you write, did he tell you to lie? Is that right? What did he actually tell you about this this affair?
Well, I go into this and talking about the conversations that we had that have been out in the public domain since 2019 about this specific prosecution and the reality of my, at the time when I was the Attorney General, being pressured to interfere with a prosecution. I know that SNC has been discussed at length and certainly forms the backdrop for a significant part of my experience in the federal government and in federal politics. And that's why I've placed excerpts or, you know, discussions about that reality for me from a very personal perspective in terms of how I felt. And again, I will say that the Prime Minister or Justin Trudeau is entitled to say what he wants and deliver the lines that he wants. But I detail very clearly my experience. And I think that people that read the book can judge for themselves.
Here's what he said. I mean, he's been obviously asked about this on the campaign trail, obviously intensely. Here's what he said in response to your book.
I did not want her to lie. I would never do that. I would never ask her that. That is simply not true. These issues that were brought up have been talked about over the past couple of years now. They've been studied out in committee. The Globe and others have written on them extensively. They were fully looked at before the last election.
So he says, I did not want her to lie. I would never do that. I would never ask it to do it. It is simply not true. He says what you're writing is, again, these are his words, simply not true. Is he lying or what? Or are you? Is it he said, she said?
Well, what I can say and how I have always lived my life, both in private and in my public life, I am notorious for being a copious note taker and for relaying my experiences. And that's what I've sought to do in speaking the truth and providing, you know, some insight into the experiences that I've had as a federal minister and as a member of parliament.
You're a note taker, but you also recorded conversations with the then clerk of the Privy Council. One, some people think that's a sign that you shouldn't have been trusted. Others think it's a sign that you were trying to get an insurance policy. Did you ever think of recording a conversation with Justin Trudeau? And did you ever record a conversation with him?
Well, no, I haven't ever recorded a conversation with Justin Trudeau, and I do go into speaking about my reasons why I recorded that conversation with the then clerk of the Privy Council, and that has a lot to do with the reality and the environment that was unfolding around me. But I will say, and I know the media has focused a great deal on SNC with respect to, you know, and drawing the connection to my book coming out, but the book is far more than SNC, but it, you know, it is a significant reality of my experience as a federal cabinet minister, and is reflective of more of the dynamics around governance in this country, how government operates, and I hope through this book to provide some insight into that.
But the timing, it's not lost on anybody. Is this an attempt to relitigate a lot of things that were part of the last election on SNC and bring them up? In other words, don't trust Justin Trudeau. He's not the guy that you think he is. He's not the feminist prime minister that he says he is. He doesn't tell the truth. These are all in your book. And I'm just trying to wonder, did you time it specifically to hurt him in this election campaign?
I have been through, you know, the last couple of years, been very reflective on my experience. And it was a difficult decision for me to decide to put those reflections in a book and have that book published. I had announced that I was writing this book and announced through my publisher that it was going to be published in the fall. That wasn't a secret. And the publication date today, September 14th, and I'm proud of the book, was announced before what I think to be a very unnecessary election, having been called by Justin Trudeau.
So it wasn't moved up? I just want to be clear. You're saying that the timing of this in the last week of the federal election, and this, you know, you've name-checked in the debate, you're saying the timing is not also political, that it's coincidental, that it's not a political way to influence people's vote on Justin Trudeau and the Liberal government?
Well, I mean, people can look at the timeline of when I announced the book, and I don't necessarily think that that is, I mean, the issue for me. You know, the September 14th date was announced before the federal election was called. You know, I'm happy to speak about this book. I feel, as the member of Parliament for Vancouver Granville, as a former cabinet minister, that my experiences within government are something that I'm open to talking about. And beyond that, having conversations about really important issues that are facing our country. And, you know, one was in the newspaper today talking about Indigenous reconciliation, talking about how government works, talking about the nature and the reality of partisan politics and its influence. Mm. So having discussions around these important issues while people are considering how to exercise their franchise, how to vote. You know, these are discussions that we need to have, and I'm happy to contribute to that discussion.
You one of the things you talk about is when you were shuffled away from being the Minister of Justice, and you said, I was adamant in my belief, you write on page 186, that I was being shuffled because of SNC-Lavalin from the first moment. The Prime Minister and Jerry Butts were adamant this was not the case. Those positions won't change. But you said, I believe I was shuffled, you say, frankly, for improper and unethical reasons. I don't know what the motive are, and we can always impute motive on things, but isn't it the purview of the Prime Minister to shuffle whoever he or she wants? They can do it, you serve at the pleasure of the Prime Minister. If they want to move you, they can move you. Is it really your right to decide what cabinet position you get or not?
Well, I'm first of all, of course, it is the prerogative of the Prime Minister, any Prime Minister, to determine individuals that he places into particular portfolios. I've never disputed that. In fact, I state that in the book. What I have relayed in part of the book is the feelings that I had around the shuffle when I was moved from Minister of Justice, Attorney General, into that Veterans Affairs, and I will say a significant portfolio that I value deeply in serving as the Minister of Veterans Affairs. But I sought to, in this book, to relay, as I said, the feelings around that. And I do not believe that I can determine which portfolio I am in, but what I have sought to do is reflect how I felt about being moved from one portfolio to the other and frankly, being offered other portfolios.
I got to leave it there. Jody Wilson-Raybould, I really appreciate you joining us again. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So it's a powerful book, Jody Wilson-Raybould, an indictment of Justin Trudeau. Now, the question is, what's new? Just on the publication date, some people have asked me. On January, March 10th, she tweeted out, the publication date of my new book will be October 12th. And then in July, when there was rumors of the election, she said, I'm pleased to note that HarperCollins has moved up the publication date to September 14th. So it was rushed up as there was rumors of the election. Okay, we're going to take a break. Retired General Rick Hillier, the former chief of the defense staff, joins us. I really want you to stay with us. There's a story about a hero in Afghanistan that there's a movement to give him the Canadian Victoria Cross for the first time. When you hear this story of heroism, you're going to want to stand up and honor him.
talking to the newsmakers every day. The conversation continues with Evan Solomon.
There's a lot of talk about Afghanistan and the failure leaving people behind. Afghan interpreters are actually in front of Parliament Hill today. There's potentially a hunger strike. But I'm going to tell you a story now about a hero. And this is the kind of story we need. A hero whose name is not known but should be. A hero who should receive the Canadian Victoria Cross, according to a new organization called Valor in the Presence of the Enemy, which is a not-for-profit. And it's one of the key members is someone you know, retired General Rick Hillier, who was the former chief of the defense staff who led the mission in Afghanistan. And he's here now, and I always thank you for your service, General Hillier. Great to have you here. And I want people, this story moved me so profoundly, and I want you to tell the story to our listeners across the country about Private Jess Randall LaRochelle. What's his story?
Evan, thank you, first of all, and glad to be on the show. And listen, Canadians should remember that name, Jess LaRochelle, an awesome young man, a young Canadian who served our nation when we asked him, who stood up and stood tall. On the 14th of October in 2006, he was with the 1st Battalion Royal Canadian Regiment Battle Group in Kandahar Province in Pashmal area. They were in what was called Strong Point Center, a small area that we had, I wouldn't say fortified, but we had taken over to try to provide security to a route that we were helping the Afghans build to try and increase the commerce and their mobility throughout the area. The Taliban attacked at every opportunity they got. And Strong Point Center was one of those places to help secure it. The platoon that went in there to secure that area was down in strength. They'd taken some losses before. The replacements had not yet come in. They had a vehicle go down, which meant the section in that vehicle went with it back in the Kandahar airfield. So they were under strength. They knew that an attack was probably coming because the Taliban wanted to kick them out of there. And they were short, so they wanted somebody into the observation post that was facing towards the most likely area. Only one person stuck his hand up and volunteered to go in there, Private Jess LaRochelle. Go in there by himself. You never put just one person in an observation post unless it's really dire circumstances. You always have two in case one goes down. The machine gun there requires two people normally to handle it. And Jess put his hand up and said he would go into the observation post. He went in there. The area Strong Point Center got attacked. Machine gun fire, rocket-propelled grenade fire, perhaps some anti-tank weapons, as in recoilless rifles. One of those rocket-propelled grenades exploded over Jess in the observation post, shredded the observation post itself, impacted upon him some of that shrapnel. And he said he looked up one time and he thought he was dreaming because of the little explosions overhead, which were mini bomblets that came out of that rocket-propelled grenade that detonated over him. The observation post was pretty much destroyed. He was banged up a lot. He fired a machine gun at the attacking enemy, about 20 Taliban fighters. As heavy machine gun fire came in on him, more rocket-propelled grenades came in on him. He fired his machine gun until he ran out of ammunition. And then he picked up some, there were some 15 M72
rocket launchers.
And they're about cardboard tubes. He picked them up next to him and started firing them one at a time, taking the caps off, extending them, bringing the sight up, firing at the Taliban. I mean, it was a miracle, first of all, that they had not detonated during the explosion. So broke up the Taliban attack. His platoon commander, Lieutenant Corby, came rushing up there under fire, and he was a hero himself that day also. And he sang out to see if anybody was alive. He said, I thought there was nobody in that observation post still alive. It was destroyed so badly. And Jess LaRochelle's head poked up. And he doesn't like to be called this, but his baby face was looking back at the platoon commander. And he said, I'll give you covering fire. Come on in. Lieutenant Corby went into the observation post with him, said, I got nobody else to bring up here with you. We've got no cannon in fire support right now because two of the Lav 3 cannons have jammed because of the sand, and you've got to hold on here. And that's exactly what Jess LaRochelle did. He held on over some hours, helped keep the Taliban at bay, save the rest of the platoon, save Strong Point Center. And then that night moved with the rest of his platoon when they were relieved there back to Kandahar airfield because they had two of their battle buddies killed in that attack, moved back to Kandahar airfield to take part in that ramp ceremony, Evan, which you know so well, participated and helped carry the body of one of his battle buddies onto the aircraft at home. And only after it was on there and he had said his farewell did he say to one of the medics who was at hand there, "I'm really hurting. Can you have a look at me?" And it was discovered because of the rocket-propelled grenades exploding overhead, his back was broken. And so he was horribly injured, in great pain, refused to abandon his position, fought the fight alone from that observation post, used the weapons at hand, said farewell to his friend by participating in the ramp ceremony, and has been paying a heavy price ever since. He was awarded the Star of Military Valor on the because of that action on the 14th of October. I think he was awarded it on the 14th of March, 07. And that's the second highest award for valor. We and our small group, Valor in the Presence of the Enemy, think that there are things that now we know that in the context of this scenario, the fact that he volunteered, the fact that the cannon were down and could not support him, the fact that he had, you know, a machine gun, which is a two-person weapon, and he was handling it himself, we think those things should be reconsidered. And we believe that Jess LaRochelle, incredible Canadian, deserves the Canadian Victoria Cross.
Speaking of General Rick Hilliers, telling the story of October 14th, 2006, the story of Private Jess LaRochelle. Folks, how old was Jess at that moment? He's 20. He was, this is not Rambo. He was a, as you describe him, a slight 20-year-old with a broken back. Two of his comrades were killed, four injured. And he never stopped, and he saved Canadian lives, and he did extraordinary things. And now Jess LaRochelle is in the hospital, and he's suffering. And I want people to know why this is important, because some people think, well, of course he should have the Canadian Victoria Cross. It was created in 1993. But General Hillier, how many people have ever received this?
Nobody has ever received the Canadian Victoria Cross, Evan. This would be a first.
And it's important that he gets it now, because he's paid a heavy price, and his life is in his a price that may cost him his life, right?
It may, and hopefully he will not, but it certainly may, and we just think it's important that he gets it because he deserves it.
Tell us a bit about Jess now. Does he know you're doing this?
Yes, he does, and I have not spoken with him directly in his last days here, Evan, but I am going to. He indicated that he did not want to do any interviews himself, that if the Victoria Cross should be awarded, he would be privileged to receive it, but he also indicated he did want to speak to me, so I'm going to do that. He is in hospital. He's a sick individual. He's not well at all, obviously, and we're all worried about that. About what this great Canadian, I think I've said that three times now because I believe it so much, what this great Canadian is going through. And it's directly as a result of his combat and the operations and the wound that he took with a broken back in Afghanistan. So, you know, he's gone through a rough period of time since his release from the Canadian forces. And when I saw him, as I said, he was just a small, slim, and very young-looking soldier who just stood up for Canada. In an unbelievable way. He would have made the Smokey Smiths of the world and the Major Currys who won the Victoria Cross in World War II. He would have made them proud. He would have been one of them.
You've written a letter to the Governor General, retired General Rick Hilliers, and a group of people who want to celebrate Private LaRochelle. He deserves to be the first Canadian to be awarded the Canadian Victoria Cross. That is heroism, people, and bravery. Let's honor it.
You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
It is that time of the day when we decide to open the door and step inside the war room.
Let me be perfectly clear.
Putting out misinformation.
And we hear them.
Misleading politics.
What's really important here.
Spreading it online.
Unequivocally.
The War Room.
Joined today by the great and powerful Tasha Carradine, a principal at Navigator and a national political columnist. Also by the wonderful and the mellifluous, the golden-throated medalark, Tom Mulcair, CTV political analyst and former NDP leader. And also by Zane Velji. No, just kidding. The wonderful and the handsome... Zane Valji, political campaign strategist and partner at Northwest.
Seems like some formerly worked with the Calgary mayor.
What I'm doing, and you don't even catch what I'm doing, Zane, and this is why it's sad. What I'm doing here, would you like to know what I'm doing?
Yeah, lay it on me. I'd love you to know what you're doing.
I have upped your compliments. I've inflated your introductions by 4.1%, the fastest inflation of your compliments since 2003, because the subject is inflation. So what I'm doing is inflating everybody by 4.1%. And that is only 4.1% inflation.
Take note, everyone. Take note when we have to introduce Evan ever. Thank you, Evan. I really appreciate it.
You'll never finish.
That's right. But that's what I'm saying. Now you realize what a big deal 4.1% inflation is. Tom, how big a deal is, on a serious note, signs of inflation? Remember, the Bank of Canada targets 2% as the normal. We've got the biggest inflation jump since 2.3%. I know they say if you strip out housing and groceries, it's like, yeah, if you strip out a heart attack from a heart attack, it's everything's great. But, you know, who can live without homes and groceries? But how big a deal is this?
It's a huge deal. And it goes back to an exchange with Mr. Trudeau at the beginning of the campaign, trying to make himself sound a little bit higher up than everybody else. They said, well, you know, what about inflation? And he said, well, I don't have any time for monetary policy. I'm worried about families. This just in. Inflation affects families. Ask anybody who bought a house in the 80s. Our first house, mortgage rate, 13.5%. The guy at the bank said, take 1 year. It can't stay at 13.5. He was right. We renewed at 21%.
Oh, my God.
That's inflation. That's the reality. And this is what is staring people in the face. We've been outbidding ourselves in all of our large cities to buy homes at prices that far exceed any real value in them. We've got a massive housing bubble right now. Any slight increase in inflation will have an attendant increase in the interest rates that are being charged to those families. So this is a huge issue. And I think that it's something that the Conservatives might have been able to own a little bit more, because Mr. Trudeau doesn't seem to master the file at all.
Tasha, we've lived with the insurance genie in the bottle for a long time. Now, whether it's coming out permanently or impermanently is a great debate. But, you know, a couple of days left in a campaign and an inflation rate at 4.3%, that's not good news.
It's not good news anywhere. It's happening all over the world. And, I mean, the States, it's causing problems for Biden as well. And one of the reasons it's happening is governments are spending and throwing money into the economy. And they've been doing it for 18 months now, initially to keep people from essentially economic collapse when COVID was, you know, preventing people from literally leaving their home. Now we have a better handle on what the pandemic do's and don'ts are, but they're still spending. And this government is no exception. It continued CERB up until the election date, actually. I mean, I don't think that's an accident, right? So the problem when you're doing that and you're borrowing money, you've got also inflation in all sorts of areas, not just housing, but you've got inflation in the building materials, gasoline, all sorts of things are going up for all sorts of reasons. But the cumulative effect of all this is that we're seeing this high inflation rate, and it is a problem. Fixing the housing market, as people call it, fixing won't just fix the problem. Government has to get a handle on itself. And in fact, none of them are proposing any kind of restraint. It's all big spending. And even the Tories, they won't balance the books for another 10 years.
Zane. He's not even answering.
Zane is so shocked, doesn't know what to say.
Yeah. What's happening? You know what? He needs a compliment. The beautiful and brilliant and loquacious and garrulous Zane Valji. Nothing?
Crickets.
Sorry, Evan. I just lost you there.
Sure, if, sure.
Go again one more time.
You didn't hear the compliment, right?
I just cut out.
Unbelievable. Is this unbelievable? Can you believe this? Okay, fine. I'll say it again. Over to you, Zane.
Oh, okay, thank you. Cash was right. Gasoline up a third. Travel prices up 20%. Home replacement up 15%. I mean, the UK is also nearing 4% inflation in August. This would be bad for Trudeau, barring two things. Number one, runway. We have very little of it and very hard to make this a soak time argument for folks, unless the Conservatives are very clever and extremely ham-fisted, which, by the way, they've shown to be in this election. So there could be some credence to that. And secondly, you know, inflation is hard for people to understand. Let's be totally clear. I understand that people can understand that things are getting more expensive. But this is one of those things that people understand. We're in a pandemic. We're in an era where we need to spend? What were the choices here? I think that's been pretty well laid out. But the biggest thing that is to Trudeau's advantage, because this should hurt way more than it will, is the fact that we've only got 5 days left. And it'll be very hard to make this relevant argument.
Yeah, Tasha, why do you disagree? Because it's not like the Conservatives have an austerity plan. If there was a contrast election, it might be. But they're spending almost the exact same amount.
I agree, but they're not painting it that way. And the airwaves here in Toronto, where I am, saturated with liberal inflation. That's what the two words they're putting together. Very clever, liberal inflation. Driving down the highway to Mississauga today, all I saw were gigantic illuminated billboards with Trudeau's face. Have you had enough of liberal inflation? 4.1%. Like, that's what it said. So it's in people's faces. They are seeing this. And if they do equate the two, Trudeau's in trouble. I agree. If they don't, then okay, no. But every effort's being made to tie this government to the inflation rate.
I think there's another element, right? A, you mentioned it, Tasha. This is global. It's not like this is just Canada. B, to Evan's point, every party is spending. And C, how much of a gaffe or give a expletive factor will this actually be to when people vote at the ballot box? Can they not just put this in front of people's minds but make this the issue that people vote on? I doubt that with the runway we have.
I agree with both of you. Hold on. I also think that what they're doing is they're defining their adversary. They're defining the Justin Trudeau who sort of huffs, I don't care about that monetary stuff. I'm taking care of families. They're basically saying, you can't let this guy run anything. That's the overarching message here. It's not the 4.1%, because that, for the average person under 35, doesn't mean anything. But for older folks, you know, like nearing retirement, who have been through this ringer, sort of going, I remember that, and it was ugly, you know, and it really affected our lives. So they're looking at Trudeau saying, maybe not this time. So those are the voters that are, I think, that O'Toole is aiming for. Middle-of-the-road voters, sometimes they vote blue, sometimes they vote red. You know, he's not going to be able to touch the NDP's voters over this, and it's absolutely fascinating to watch. Singh is really holding on to his voters. And the Liberals are now making open calls. It's usually done subtly, you know, don't split the vote. Now it's, don't vote for the NDP because I won't win. Mm-hmm. And the guy who thought he was entitled to call an election to get a majority, that's all it was about, was him, now figures that he's entitled to your vote. You're not allowed to vote for anybody else except him. That's what's coming through right now. And I don't think it's working very well for the Liberals.
So what I want to do is signs of confidence or signs of desperation? Because at this point, there's a lot of little things happening. Jean Chrétien's out on the stump for Mr. Trudeau. Sign of strength or sign of desperation? I've never seen a Mr. Harper's not, but I got about a minute. But Tasha, you see Chrétien, but you don't see Harper. Is that a sign of desperation or a sign of confidence?
You also saw Hazel McCallion this morning, again, a Mississauga reference, but came out in favor of Trudeau. Signs of desperation to me. I think they're worried. Trudeau on Bill 21 today, trying to keep up the Quebec vote, sign of desperation. I think he's worried. So I really do think the Liberals are worried, and they have reason to be.
Yeah, okay. So can we do signs of confidence, signs of desperation, not personal ones? If you guys have your own flexes of confidence, obviously, my introduction was a sign of desperation because Zane's hosting the show tomorrow, and I'm obviously very worried about that.
It'll be a great show, folks. Yeah, you will get
enough funny and finally funny.
Finally funny. I know. Like, finally funny because you know that
no
joke.
No dad looks, jokes.
Oh, look at you. Look at you. Like, you're
I've converted Tom.
Mulcair is dissing me for a dad joke? Mulcair? Oh, my God. Okay. Tom, you know what that is? Do you know what that is, Mulcair? That's a sign of desperation. That's a sign of desperation. Okay. Signs of desperation, signs of confidence on the campaign trail. Zane, Tash, Tom, we're all there as we look ahead.
When important decisions are made, we report. Here's Evan Solomon.
We are just days away from Election Day, and you might wonder, why are some politicians afraid of the calendar? Because its days are numbered. I'm just kidding. That's because this is the funniest section of the show with Zane Velji, Tasha Carradine, and Tom Mulcair.
Just crickets. Just letting you know.
Because its days are numbered. Because it's a calendar. See, like it's a... Nothing. Signs of desperation and signs of confidence. That is a sign of confidence when you can tell that joke. Is it a sign of desperation or a sign of confidence Tom, I'll start with you, that Justin Trudeau has pulled out Mr. Chrétien. Great. Here's what Mr. Chrétien said, as a proxy to attack Erin O'Toole. Here's what he said.
When I look at the leader of the opposition, you know he's doing things that I cannot do on child care, on gun control, on abortion, on climate change. He's speaking on both sides of his mouth.
Good line from Jean Chrétien, right?
Fabulous line.
Fabulous line.
Self-deprecating humor works with politicians like crazy. And he's just such a crowd pleaser. I mean, he's still so sharp and he's still having so much fun doing it. But it is definitely a sign of desperation. They're bringing him into the GTA, into an area that has half a dozen seats that could go either way. They know exactly what they're doing. They're bringing out the old warhorse for one last turn. But I do think that it smacks of desperation, despite the fact that I really like that sort of speech from Jean Chrétien, as somebody I've always had a lot of admiration for.
Yeah, and Tasha, then the Liberals had to answer questions, Mr. Trudeau, about, hey, were you following COVID protocols? There was too many people in the room.
Yep.
That became an issue. On the other hand, he's like, wait, I got Hazel McCallum and Jean Chrétien giving me endorsements. I'll take that. Or is it, again, sign of confidence that he's got these proxies, or sign of desperation that he needs this in the GTA?
Well, signs they're coming out now, I think, is a sign of desperation. As I said earlier, I don't. I think that the Liberals are worried. They're worried about the GTA. They're worried about vote splits there. As Tom said, Singh is holding on to his vote. They are encouraging him, they're encouraging NDP voters not to do so with Trudeauites, because they know that they need to get those voters if they're going to prevent the Tories from taking seats in the 905. And that event yesterday was shocking. Honestly, to see that many people all packed together and, yeah, wearing masks, but still, I mean, really, was that necessary? It just flies the whole point of why are we having an election in a pandemic, hanging over that like a bad smell. And so I think it was foolish planning on the part of his people to do that at this time.
Zane, what do you make of Mr. O'Toole? He's now kind of said on a number of things, well, in British Columbia, you know what? It's a three-way race there. I may not actually force through or want the Trans Mountain Pipeline, the Northern Gateway Pipeline, because it doesn't exist anymore, even though I was promising that. Is it a sign of confidence or desperation that he's recalibrating his positions on a number of things? He wrote a letter to Quebec saying, maybe I will give you the $6 billion for the child care. We'll negotiate on that. Sign of confidence, sign of desperation.
Every politician will say that that's a sign of strategy. What it actually is it's a sign of desperation. It's a sign of saying that, most Canadians in this election still feel like Mr. Trudeau is going to win. That polling has been consistent the entire time, despite where the horse race has been. So you're stacked up against some difficult odds here, despite the fact of your early surge and now your neck and neck polling. And so the regionality of this, really matters. You needed to have the Legault thing. You need to have revised policies in BC to make yourself palatable. You probably need one more thing that you don't have just yet, which is an anchor to your right to keep the PPC number as low as possible. So if you are O'Toole, this is in the same column as Trudeau. Yeah, it's a little bit desperate, but we've seen this endgame strategy everywhere, which is, where do we tweak? Where do we throw out the playbook? And what do we need to do in terms of real-time reaction to try to make that coalition, that tent, as large as we can? Can I just make one more comment, Evan, on my telltale sign for desperation? I'm seeing it from both campaigns. It's the kitchen sink approach. When you show up without necessarily a crisp, explicit message, but you show up and you list the entire policy book, or you do a 20-page list of what you're up to me, that shows that you're just trying to get anything that sticks with anyone in that crowd or anyone that's watching. To me, that's the telltale sign of desperation in the final endgame.
Driftnet politicking, I'll take anything.
Anything, Tom, I'll take it all. Yeah,
Tom, what do you make about Erin O'Toole in Quebec? Is that a sign of strength? He's got the 10 seats, or is it a sign of desperation? My God, after that English language debate, I just got to hold fire. Last days he's in Quebec. What does that tell you?
He's trying to hold on to his seats because this thing that has caught fire, the English debate, it's going to be a week since that debate, but it's still out there every single day. It's on the air nonstop. So Blanchet has shored up his rather weak vote. It was anything but sure that he was going to be able to hold on to his seats. He'll now do that. He'll probably steal a few from the Libs and maybe one or two from the Conservatives. It looks like Max Bernier is starting to really close in on the conservatives in his own riding. The very existence, though, and I'll give you an idea that we haven't heard that much, but I think that the very existence of the People's Party of Canada and Bernier can subtly help O'Toole, because O'Toole gets to say, look, I am so middle of the road. I've even got this guy chasing me on the right. He's the right wing nut bird. I'm not. You can go and, you know, say all sorts of things about him, on a woman's right to choose, on vaccines and all that stuff, all the stuff you're trying to stick to me, but I'm a middle of the road guy. So that might actually work in terms of defining himself. But the fact that he flew up to Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean to Mr. Martel's riding, for me, desperation. This should have been an easy one for them, but they're trying to shore up their flank in Quebec.
And just on that, and maybe Tasha, you just weigh in. Tom's saying, you know, I'm a middle of the road. Today, Aaron O'Toole said, this is not your father or your grandfather's Conservative Party. Look again. He's changed a lot of things. He was no longer the true blue guy that he ran on. Is he a conservative of convenience or a conservative of conviction? Is that an issue for him?
You mean for O'Toole?
Yeah, for Mr. O'Toole.
I think, yeah, okay. Because Bernier, I think, no, certainly conviction is not an issue for him. I think he's a conservative of conviction. He has flip-flopped to the points that were made earlier. He's reversed himself on several policies that he felt were going to be harmful, looking at the gun reversal in particular, in terms of broadening the tent. That doesn't mean that he doesn't have convictions. I think he is a politician of conviction, but I think he's also pragmatic enough to know that you have to bring enough people along with you if you're going to get anything done. So the Conservatives always have to walk that balance. I feel O'Toole is a genuine person. I think people can connect to him as a genuine guy, an ordinary guy who believes in things and is out there doing his best for them. He doesn't seem to come across with the hidden agenda tag that, you know, other politicians of conservative stripes have had in the past. He doesn't strike me that way. But at the end of the day, it's just it's his party and not just him. And that is, I think, the bit of the albatross. O'Toole, I think, I haven't seen polling if he polls above his party, but I would suspect that at this point he actually might.
Yeah. Last minute to you, Zane, just on Mr. Jagmeet Singh. He was on CBC. He could not answer a clear question whether he would kill the Trans Mountain Pipeline. He let go two candidates for anti-Semitic remarks. When you let go candidates like that, you boot two people in key ridings in Toronto area. Sign of strength or sign of desperation?
I guess you'd say a sign of strength, but all outright desperation, especially on the pipeline file, right? He's seeing some progress and some potential in Alberta. Doesn't want to ruin that for a couple of candidates there. So he has a foothold, still has some sort of prairie presence. So I suspect it's part of that, especially with also the more pro-business crowd in the 905. But the letting go of the two candidates, why did they pass vetting? Why now? Too late. And in strategic areas, man, you can't give that up, especially if you're trying to draw daylight between you and the PM. And this race is going to be fought in like 50 to 60 places in the GTA at the end of the day. We've been saying that for 4 days now. If you want to be in the mix, you can't have that happen in the early stage of this campaign.
There was something slightly desperate when Mr. Singh tried to say, no, they left on their own. I didn't ask them.
Yeah.
Come on.
Oh, yeah. No,
that.
Of course. No. Of course.
Guys, it is, if you're celebrating the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, I wish you an easy fast. I know Tom, part of your family does for sure.
Yep.
If I have offended you, and I know I have probably, I'm genuinely sorry. You guys, the three of you have been so brilliant. I mean this. The three of you are so brilliant, and it's such an enjoyable part of the day. You know, to me, I'm like a pencil with an eraser on both sides in this discussion. I'm pointless. And you three are fantastic. So thank you so much.
And we're going to come back and haunt you after the election.
Yeah, no kidding.
You're not getting rid of us that easy.
No.
Yeah, we don't want to leave.
Tom, Tash, Zane, thank you so much. Ask me anything about the election next.
Helping you through these unique times. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the program, everyone. What a program. I really do genuinely love that war room panel, those three, Tasha, Tom, and Zane. And, of course, Rick Hillier, still resonating, that story about the hero in Afghanistan. Many of you are asking, and you often ask, I want some straight answers on this election. So let's do an Ask Me Anything. Ask me anything about the election. What are you expecting these last critical days? This is an AMA. 1-855-633-1010, 1-855-633-1010, or 71010. Ask me anything on the election. 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Here are some questions I've got. Evan, do you think the 5.8 million people who already voted will have an impact? Who does it help and who does it hurt? Normally, early voting helps two groups. One, the conservative base, which is always the most motivated. The 30% of the constituency that vote conservative is usually the most motivated, and they get out early. But the liberals recently, since 2015, have had the best ground game, the get out the vote. So it may help them as well. The reason why this is hard to tell is no one's sure if this shows enthusiasm or paranoia. If it shows enthusiasm, it probably will benefit the conservatives, in my view. If it shows paranoia, in other words, people are just voting early, and this is what I actually think, because they don't want to stay in long lines because of COVID, then it can split evenly. It may not be really a signal of any big momentum yet. We certainly have had a lot fewer mail-in ballots. Elections Canada thought we'd have 4 to 5 million. We've had 1 million. Fraser, you're on the line, 1-855-633-1010. Ask me anything. What's up?
Thanks, Evan. What do you think happens to Trudeau if he wins another minority? We know he went for the majority on this one. What happens if he's back with a similar seat count within the Liberal Party?
Nothing. It's a good question. Some people keep asking, would he resign? To quote Jean Chrétien on politics, a win is a win is a win. Look, just think about this, Fraser. 1968, Pierre Trudeau wins a massive majority. Trudeau mania. By 1972, Trudeau mania has burned off like a fog over the lake. And he barely squeaks by Robert Stanfield. In fact, Stanfield was called to win the election at one point in the night. He beats Stanfield by 2 seats in a very thin minority government in 72, barely holding on. Then he wins a majority, as you know, in 74. He stays on if he wins. If it's a thin minority for Justin Trudeau, his brand is burnt. In other words, he stays on. He doesn't resign, but immediately there'll be leadership questions because people will think, that's it, he's won his three and he's done. I don't think he stays on, and then I think within 18 months he'll announce that he's leaving and there'll be a new leader. I just don't see him hanging on, but he will not resign, Fraser, if he does not get the majority. Good question, though, Fraser. I appreciate that. 1-855-633-1010. Fraser, the other question is, what happens if Mr. Trudeau remains as a minority? Does Mr. O'Toole keep his job? He's moved the center. Remember, Andrew Scheer won the popular vote, won seats in the House, and lost his job. And he took Trudeau from a majority to a minority. If Aaron O'Toole doesn't win, does he keep his job? So there's a lot of questions here on Ask Me Anything. 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Hey, do you think term limits should be instituted for every politician at every level in Canada? Says Tom, no. I don't, Tom, and I'll tell you why. First of all, I know lifetime politicians bug a lot of people, but I trust the people in the riding. If someone's just sitting there and sitting on a position and not doing their job, I trust voters and Canadians to toss them out. Sometimes you have a politician that's been there for a long time and they're doing it. Look at Hazel McCallion. People love her. So I'm not sure term limits are that important. I think if people are doing a crappy job, they should be voted out. We have a mechanism of accountability. It's called voting. I think we should use that. I don't necessarily think we need to enhance it with, quote, term limits. Chris, what's up?
Yeah, I'm just curious, do you or anybody, they do stats on stuff, what's the breakdown of the pre-advanced, the early voting? Do they find that out later on? Because it's gone up 18% to what it was in 2019, and I just wondered if they know the people that went to the advanced poll, what percentage is how they voted.
Yeah, they don't know now. Unlike, great question, Chris. In the United States, they do something called exit polling, where they can actually.
I've heard such a thing, but they do polls on how many times the pitcher spits on the mound and everything. But yeah. I was just wondering in the advanced polls if they know after the election. Sort of the breakdown of who voted and how.
Yeah, we will know after, but we won't know now.
I just wondered if there's a breakdown of that, and the parties know.
Chris, we will know. The parties keep track of all these people, and party databases are really key. And the parties will know. And Elections Canada won't know necessarily, but pollsters will know. And so, we'll get a pretty decent sense. But we don't do exit polling here like in the U.S. Evan, how many seats will the People's Party get? My sense is that they're polling heavily in places that already get conservative pluralities, like in Alberta, Saskatchewan. The best chance the People's Party has is the Beauce, which is where Maxime Bernier is running. He's not there a lot. He was the conservative MP there, and his dad was. And I've heard that he's polling within 2, 3, 4 points of that. So the one seat for them would be victory, and that would put Maxime Bernier back in the Beauce. Still, though, no, it's not a lock. Thanks for the question. Adam, what's up?
Yeah, I was wondering, and I'm surprised it's never been asked. With Legault getting an endorsement, do you think any party will, part of what Quebec wants as part of becoming a better nation is to take over immigration? As long as Bill 21 is in place, do you think any party will do that?
Any party will do what? Give Quebec more control
over
immigration?
Control of immigration.
Well, Aaron O'Toole's explicitly said he will. That's his contract with Quebec. He's openly said yes.
Why isn't anybody asking him why he's doing that?
Well, he's been asked, and thanks for the question. Look, this gets to a great question. Bill, just so people know, Bill 21 is the secularization law that you're talking about that bans people who, religious minorities, Muslims, Jews, Sikhs, from wearing turbans or kippahs or hijabs in certain professions like police, judges, lawyers. It's a great question. And the politics of Quebec, as our CJAD listeners will know, are really interesting because if you press back on these things, and you saw the moderator of the leaders debate, Shachi Curl, do that, it can become a massive political issue. The Bloc loves that. They want that. They want to have this perceived slight. By the same token, how do you stand up for a law? This is not about the people of Quebec. You know, my wife works there. I live on the border. I live there. This is about, is a law discriminatory? And that law is in court right now. And the leaders have all called it discriminatory openly, and yet they will not challenge it because they're afraid if they do so, they will lose their votes and they'll hand them to the Bloc. So they are on a tightrope. I just want to answer one last question. I've got a minute here. Mike has asked me, hey, Evan, if you don't live in Toronto or Quebec, what's the point in voting? It doesn't count. Mike, completely not true. The 40-plus seats in BC may define this election. Absolutely critical. Yes, big metropolitan areas, because they have a high densities of population, really matter, but all the cities matter. So around, whether it's Calgary, whether it's Halifax, whether it's Toronto, whether it's Ottawa, whether it's Montreal, whether it's Vancouver, these matter. And let me tell you, in a close minority election where pluralities, like in other words, people are winning ridings by 100 or 500 votes, every vote in every region, rural and urban, count. And that will make the difference. You know, 6 or 7 ridings here or there is going to tell the story of who's the government or not, Mike. So I just got to push back. Every riding matters. My man, we got a lot of Ask Me Anything. So we maybe have to do that again. But we got Rick Mercer joining us as well today. So we got to get to Rick. Stay with us.
From coast to coast to coast, the newsmakers talk here. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Well, I gotta go, folks. Remember my motto, laughter is the best medicine, you know? And unless you're a diabetic. And then, insulin. It's usually much worse for it. Thanks a lot, folks. Take care of yourself.
Great comedian Norm Macdonald, Canadian obviously famous for Saturday Night Live. He wrote a great book saying it's hard to be famous for something you did so long ago, but he said the words that sum up his life, I've been lucky. Passed away after a long battle with cancer, the age of 61. Comedy plays a massive role in politics, and Norm used to satirize the news, and so did someone who you know well, Rick Mercer, Canadian comedian, a political satirist, author, just a handsome young man, mellifluous voice as well. I mean, what else can I say, Rick? Great bod?
That's all good. Just keep it coming.
Anything else?
No,
boy,
that's good.
Long, flowing hair.
No, that's enough. Oh, stop.
He can play the saxophone like Kenny G. No, I don't know.
Could do a drum solo. That's
I don't it. Know. I don't Thank know. How are you? How are you, Rick?
I'm excellent. I mean, things are good.
I mean, why not, right?
Yeah. Right? I wrote a book during the pandemic, so I had something to do. I think a lot of people in my business were suddenly set adrift. Obviously, you couldn't perform live. A lot of TV gigs disappeared, so I was lucky I had something to do. And as much as I didn't really particularly like writing a book, it was a good thing to have.
Let me ask you, in one part of your mind, is that like also a flex? Like, I know a lot of my friends are suffering, but I'll be writing a book. I will emerge from this pandemic.
No.
An author. So you're kind of flexing, like,
no,
a lot of you are suffering, but I am on the road to success.
No, that never even crossed my
mind. Yes, it did.
I hope they all come out on the other side with, like, fantastic screenplays or you know, train sets in their basement or something. I only wish them well.
Really? Because when you saw Alan Doyle come out with a book, you're like, really? You also? What's with you guys? Everyone's
well,
like, oh,
Alan
I'm ready.
Alan comes out with a book every time you turn around. I think he's on his third memoir.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
But, you know, his books are actually great, so you can't really make fun of him
I
for
know.
It.
I mean, every time you turn, there's like another song, another book. I mean, you guys.
I know. He's incredibly prolific.
But you, I feel like there's a bit of a race, but that, we don't have to get into that.
There's no race.
There's a little race. Norm MacDonald once said, you know, comedians can't really secretly enjoy other comedians being funny because we're all secretly jealous.
Comedians are a very strange breed. You know, I can talk about Norm as a comedian because I'm such a fan, and I'm a fan of stand-up comedy. But you know, stand-up comedy is something that I came to actually pretty late in my career. It was 2 years ago when after I left the TV show, I said, I'm going to tour the country as a stand-up. And you know, it was a big learning curve, and I loved it. And I'm working on stand-up now, but he was a true stand-up, and he was a stand-up. And a lot of people who get into stand-up, you know, people like David Letterman, one of the best stand-ups of all, the minute he got a job on television, he never did stand-up ever again. Most people in comedy, they use stand-up, and they're looking for the off-ramp. A guy like Norman MacDonald was never looking for the off-ramp. He was always, even when he had a sitcom, even when he was doing movies, when he was doing whatever, he was always treading the boards, always working on stand-up. And, I mean, he was booked to be, someone just told me he was booked to be playing in New Jersey, like, next week or something. So,
but it's hard, right?
Like until the very end.
People don't realize, like, it's like the people that want to get off stand, like stand up and then I get a television show, that's the comedian's dream. But, you know, to Norm MacDonald or even Jerry Seinfeld, who's a real craftsperson of stand up, he loves it up there. It's hard. Like, when you were doing it and you know what it takes to be up there, how nervous were you, Rick? Like, how hard is it?
I was always nervous, but I managed to get to a point where I was having a good time. But again, I think I'm different than most comedians. That there's a lot of comedians, and I could never presume to speak about Norm in this situation, but there's a lot of comedians who that's their happy place. And maybe a lot of performers in general, like that is their happy place. Or even worse, that's where they feel the most normal. I know people who I've talked to about the last year of not being able to perform, and some of them complain about how they've taken a hit to the pocketbook, obviously, but others you can tell it's a bit more deep-seated, deep-rooted than that. Like they don't feel normal because they're not getting on the stage.
Right.
And, you know, you got to wonder, like a guy like Seinfeld, I mean, you know, by all metrics, he has all the money in the world, and yet he's still going out there and doing that. And he's playing clubs even, so to work out, because that's obviously his happy place.
I mean, those guys should just sit at home and write a book, right?
I mean,
come on, guys, just write a book. Can we talk? Can we talk about the election for a minute?
Sure.
I mean, you've been watching elections for a long time. This is the weirdest election I can remember because it's an election about calling the election, which usually only lasts about 48 hours. This is like a meta election.
This is the problem with political parties. I've seen it time and time again. They all follow conventional wisdom in a country that's not that old. And they follow conventional wisdom, and they just say that. Oh, we'll call the election, and people will be outraged, and they'll say, should we call an election? But don't worry, on day four, people will stop asking that question, and they'll move on. That's the way it is. Well, not this time. And, you know, the other thing that I think is going on is governments get thrown out. There's no doubt about it. Doesn't mean you can be the best government in the world. Eventually, you will get thrown out because people tire of you. Now, on paper, Trudeau shouldn't really be facing that yet, except the last 2 years, to most people, felt like 7 years. Like, people feel like, my God, when is this going to end? So he may only be 2 and a bit years into his mandate, but people feel like it's been 5 or 7. So people are exhausted and worn out, and no one has ever called an election under these circumstances before.
Yeah, well, and he had an overexposure. Like, and I've called this the Viagra election call. If the election call lasts for more than 4 hours, call your doctor. It's something's going wrong. That has happened here. It's also real.
You know, people say like, oh, well, like we handled this situation so well, of course we'll get reelected. Well, look at Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
He won the war, for God's sakes.
Yeah, and you ask any people, everybody remember Clement Attlee? You're like, who's that? He's the guy that beat Winston Churchill in July of 1945. What?
Oh, Clement. Yeah, really.
Good old Clement Attlee. What do you think? What are you watching for in the end days here?
I'm not watching as closely as I used to be. I mean, there was a time, Evan, where I'd crawl over broken glass to get on those planes, and I did. I would, you know, pitch myself to McLean's magazine or whoever would have me, and I would get out there on the campaign trail. I'm less interested now than I ever have been, but also because I think it's the theater, the part that drew me to politics originally, the theater, the absurdity is less of a factor now, and there's a level of animosity out there, a level of anger that I've never seen before, and it worries me. So there's no joy in Mudville for me in this campaign. What am I watching? I'm just watching to see it get nastier and nastier over the final weeks. I mean, the slogging back and forth between O'Toole and Trudeau is pretty vicious at this point, and I can only imagine it'll get worse, especially if you look at Nanos this morning. I think they've got the Conservatives back up. So the people around Aaron O'Toole are going to say, double down, say even worse things about him.
Yeah, well.
And vice versa.
Yeah, it's worrisome. Rick Mercer, obviously comedian, love having you on, honoring Norm MacDonald, talking about the election. He's probably going to leave this phone call, folks, and say, boy, Evan thinks he just interviewed me. I just wrote another book.
No.
Yeah, you
no,
probably
but
did.
I've watched 3 Norm MacDonald clips, and I suggest that everyone do that.
Oh, you're right.
Because I think, you know, there are people probably in the country who are seeing this outpouring about Norman.
Oh, watch Norm MacDonald. You're right,
like,
Rick.
Literally, and people are maybe not aware or maybe just knew.
All right, hang on. I got to go. I got to wrap it up.
Late night fans, like, just
I love you, Rick.
The hell out of them.
We'll
you
be back tomorrow.
The hell out of them tonight.